I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with James Galbraith, an economics professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and is chairman of the board of the Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, Inequality and Industrial Change, A Global View, and The Predator State. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good evening.
And in terms of the of where we stand with these two budgets, first of all, we don't have a budget for 2011, and they're talking about the 2012 budget and operating on what are they? It's called a continuing resolution. And don't we hit the the rubber hits the road right on March the 4th?
Well, that's right. There will have to be action taken at that time. You're referring to the debt ceiling?
Yes, the debt ceiling, and
yeah.
Yes. So in terms of the overall discussion, we've got two budgets here to talk about: the Republican House's budget proposals, as much as we know about them, and the president's that have been released today. It seems to me, James Galbraith, that just in terms of the emperor's clothes, there are three big lies, to my mind, that are muddying the waters. And just let me know whether you think I'm on the right track here. One, that we should even be talking about cutting the deficit and not stimulating the economy. Two, we're only arguing about 12% of the overall budget. And three, that revenues, which are the only ways to redress the deficit, are not on the table.
True, for the most part. I think there are, in fact, some revenue increases in the Obama budget. It's about, I think, one-third of the projected savings, at least according to the news reports that I've seen. But broadly, yes, I'm actually encouraged by the extent to which this is become political theater. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think the Republicans have done what they did in 1981 and 1985. They've yielded to what you might call their inner Edna St. Vincent Millay. You know, my candle burns at both ends. It shall not last the night. When the Republicans come to power abruptly, there's always a faction inside the Republican Party that says, we've got to do everything right away. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. We've got to enact our agenda because our moment of dominance may not last. And in 1981, that led to the so-called Reagan Revolution, which got them a backlash in the 82 elections. And in 95, it led to the Gingrich Revolution, which got them a backlash in 96. Clinton was reelected in 98 when the Democrats came back. So this is a historic tendency, which I think we're seeing repeated. Extraordinarily draconian cuts, severe cuts in any program that supports anybody who isn't actually a Republican. And as a result, it gives the White House a political opening, which they're taking advantage of. And they're doing it by focusing on the same part of the budget, by offering some large cuts, which are quite painful to their own constituency, the cuts in low-income heating assistance being the major thing that's been in the press anyway. And then a lot of small cuts, some of which are justifiable, some of which are arguable, some of which are probably bad. Yet that gives the president and the White House the image of being both serious and reasonable. And that's going to be strong political ground for them.
But I don't feel that there's any great leadership going on here.
I didn't say there was. That's they say a political game, which is being fought out on the territory of the right wing.
Right.
I'm happy that for the moment, neither side is talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare, but I think it's almost certain that they will return to that later on. But this is an issue which, as you said, affects a small fraction of the total budget, and that at least means that the total damage will be somewhat limited. It will, however, I mean, as cuts get made, a lot of good things, useful things, will go by the boards. I don't know whether the program to clean up the Great Lakes is or is not cost-effective, but that the decision to cut that program, certainly not made on any cost-benefit grounds, is just being made because the administration was looking for something that they could sacrifice and get a headline for declaring that they were cutting.
But in terms of leadership, now it's obvious that the Congress, the House, controls the purse strings, and they've always issued a budget, and it's only since the 1920s that the president has issued a budget. But the long and the short of it is, with the president's bully pulpit, I would think that at this point it'd be great to hear somebody say, well, it's true we're only dealing with 12% of the overall budget, and that the big entitlement funds, we're under pressure to do something about Social Security, but it really does generate revenues and always has, and it's been running a surplus up until recently, and frankly, we can fix that fairly easily to make it sustainable. But the real driver of our deficit and our economic problems is out-of-control healthcare costs, and I don't know whether
I don't think this is quite correct. I mean, there are some forecasts of out-of-control healthcare costs, which cause certain people trouble. But the drivers of the deficit are, first of all, the financial crisis, the collapse of Wall Street, and the subsequent collapse of the economy, collapse of tax revenues, and then, to a lesser extent, the tax policies that we've been pursuing for quite a long time, but particularly since 2001. And the wars, well, those things are deficit drivers. The healthcare costs are largely paid in the private sector. That's where the big problem with healthcare costs is. So Medicare actually reimburses at a lower rate than private health insurance does. Mm-hmm. And Social Security, which people talk about all the time, as you say, has an offsetting revenue stream, which has for decades been much larger than the benefit payout. So Social Security on net has reduced the deficit.
So I've, to some extent, even got it wrong here by listening to this non-debate. So the real argument then for a leader to make would be, look, we're in this hole because of what happened on Wall Street recently, the trillions we spent on these wars, one of which we lost in Iraq and the Iranians won, and two that we're mired in Afghanistan. And our previous guest, a former CIA officer, said one of the reasons that the CIA missed what was happening in Egypt is that all of our resources and all of our Arab speakers are in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it seems to me that there are some very, very good political, historical arguments to be made here for how we got into the mess, let alone how we get out of it.
Yeah, I too would like to see a clear and truthful account of what is happening. I think it would also be good to have an honest rendering of the economics, but I'm not naive. The number of people who could render the economics in an honest way is very small, and it doesn't include anybody that I know of on the White House staff. I mean, I think some of them are quite good, actually, but you're not going to get a fully coherent and accurate story from any part of the political spectrum. The pressures to conform to the standard norms of discourse, to play up the deficit and the national debt as though they were really big problems, are just too great.
Well, but this deficit hoax has clearly pervaded and permeated the debate. It's the press have fallen for it.
That's my point. It's that if you're a political person, that your capacity to tell the truth in public is really quite restricted, and that's even if you're the president. That's fact. You have to be a president with an extraordinary capacity to project authority, and we haven't had one of those in. Well, I was supposed the last one was Reagan, and Reagan could project authority and could make people believe the most fantastic things, which he did, and that's part of the problem we have now.
Well, let me remind the audience again, I'm speaking with economist James Galbraith. We're talking about the president's budget, and also I'd like to talk a little bit about the Republican House's budget, which, as you know, James Galbraith, the Tea Party young freshmen weighed in a little bit. They were unhappy about the amounts being cut and wanted to get at least $100 billion out of it. Do you think they're going to get their way? Because the one thing that I find about what I could read about what they're really doing. And I think in many ways, the black ink of their budget really does state their priorities. As you know, recently the head of the EPA has been getting a tongue lashing. They seem obsessed with getting rid of the EPA, but at the same time they want to maintain a huge tax breaks for oil companies. They want to get rid of alternative energy. There seems to be a political agenda here.
You think?
Well, I think it's
a political agenda. I'm shocked to hear you.
Well,
say
I'm thinking.
Captain Renault in Rick's Casino. There are two agendas on the Republican side. One of them is, as you say, to satisfy their lobbies and their constituencies, and that is the same old reactionary business program that they have been associated with. That was the policy of the Bush administration, to turn over every regulatory agency to the worst aspect, the worst players in the regulated communities, to turn over coal mine safety to the worst mine operators, destroy the EPA, as you've described, hamstring the Food and Drug Administration. One could go on and on. And the other piece of it is to cut programs that benefit people who are not Republicans, as I said earlier. Cut low-income support programs, cut programs that support infrastructure, cut programs that support public education. This is an agenda which they feel they have an opportunity to advance, and they're advancing it very aggressively. It is interesting that principles get bent when important things are at stake, and as my friend, the great budget analyst Scott Lilly, has pointed out in a piece that the Center for American Progress published yesterday, Speaker Boehner has carefully protected a $450 million program to provide the Pentagon with a second jet engine for the Joint Strike Fighter that the Pentagon doesn't even want, has no use for, but does happen to be produced largely in Mr. Boehner's home district in the city of Dayton, as well as in Columbus, Ohio, which he's also quite close to. There's an element of pragmatism in their approach. It's not entirely driven by a pure anti-spending ideology.
Well, just so that you don't think I'm totally naive, I was about to say that I can see the fingerprints of the Koch brothers in these budget priorities. They're the Koch industries are among the country's largest polluters, and they put a lot of money into these Tea Party guys who supposedly stand for the people, not for the powerful, and yet their priorities are to take care of the oligarchs. So that's my little speech there, for what it's worth.
Well, it would hardly come as a surprise. Yeah, I think there's a lot to that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I hope to stay in touch with you as this wrangling continues.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking with James Galbraith, professor of economics at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and is chair of the board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, Inequality and Industrial Change, A Global View, and Predator State. We'll take a short break and return talking with Adele Stand about the recent CPAC meeting.